Welcome to Econ Talk, Conversations for the Curious, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Shalem College in Jerusalem and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Go to econtalk.org where you can subscribe, comment on this episode, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives with every episode we've done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is September 6, 2022, and my guest is Sonnet Biernecker-Hart, the co-founder of the Koval Distillery in Chicago. This is one in a very occasional series where I interview someone from the world of business about what their job is like to give us a glimpse of a world we may not otherwise get a glimpse of. I've interviewed the guy who sold me my car, the woman who cuts my wife's hair, the CEO of Legal Seafood, and so on, to give you a window into that hidden world. Sonnet, welcome to Econ Talk.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
You started your career as an academic, a professor.
Yes.
What was your field, and where did you teach?
Sure. My field was cultural history. I focused on German and Austrian, in particular Jewish cultural history from 1890 to 1938, and then from 1945 on. And I taught at Humboldt Universität in Berlin. I was the Walter Benjamin Chair of German Jewish Cultural History for a number of years. And I also taught at Baltimore Hebrew University as a Jewish studies professor. But I taught at a number of other universities, German lit classes, Kafka, you name it, anything related to German culture in that period.
I looked at your bio and I saw the university in Berlin. Could you say the name of it again?
Humboldt Universität.
Humboldt. I call it Humboldt, but what do I know? I thought, you know, I've never heard of it. I wonder what it's about. And I found that the following people have taught there: Albert Einstein, Karl Marx, Frederick Engels, Otto von Bismarck, W.B. Du Bois, Arthur Schopenhauer, Hegel, Walter Benjamin, who your chair was named after, Max Weber, Max Planck, and my favorite, the Brothers Grimm. So it's got a pretty good heritage, right?
It was a wonderful place to teach. I really enjoyed my time there.
But you stopped doing it. You stopped teaching. I understand something of that appeal, but most people, you know, they've invested a huge amount in their academic bona fides. They love research. You probably were interested in German, Austrian cultural history with the Jewish flavor from 18 whatever to 1938 and 45 onward. What happened?
You know, I feel that life has many chapters, and that's okay. And I am still interested in all of those things, but now I'm interested in the world of business and whiskey and gin and vodka and liqueurs and brandies, and doing that with my family in the city that I love. And I feel that there are a lot of things that draw us to do what we do. And some of it isn't just what we've spent our lives preparing to do, you know, that, you know, you go to school and you spend all of this time and you become a good researcher and that leads you down a path. But there are other things that can lead you down a path, which is, you know, your parents at some point start getting older. Maybe you want to be close to them. Maybe there's a city that you love that you just can't get a position, you know, teaching in that city. Or you can, but it's only as an adjunct professor and you've been a tenured professor for years and you're not really into that. Or maybe you just see a moment in time where you can break away and do something completely different and maybe it will be wonderful. And all of those things sort of converged. My husband and I felt as if we were at a crossroads. I was pregnant with our first child. We were living in DC at the time, but I wanted to live in Chicago. I wanted to be close to family as my parents were getting older. I enjoyed working with my husband, but we didn't have the opportunity to do that much in our other careers. And so we thought, well, maybe we could work together. We could start a family business. We could live where we want. We could be close to family. Maybe all those things are worth changing our path. And they were.
So we're going to talk about that new path in a second, but one more question about this change. Do you still read in your academic field? Do you still read any of that literature? Do you still read for pleasure in turn of the century Austrian, German, Jewish circles?
Absolutely. I mean, it never gets old for me. I mean, that's, you know, it's, I was just in Vienna a few weeks ago, and I was taking my children to Freud's house and explaining everything to them and, you know, making cross references. And, you know, it's funny, my son is taking a history class, and the teacher asked him, you know, if he has any, you know, previous experience taking history classes. And he says, you know, my mom was a history professor, so wherever we go, she stops me on the corner and gives me a lecture. So, I mean, that's sort of what happens when I go to Vienna or Berlin or any of these places. And, you know, it's wonderful.
So I understand this urge to go to a particular city, maybe where your parents are, and the idea of starting with a business with your husband or spouse, could be deeply appealing to others, less so. And, you know, that's person specific, obviously.
True.
But why did you decide to do something that, when I contemplate it, starting a distillery, strikes me as something that would be impossible, right? I could imagine opening a grocery store, a bookstore, a factory of a certain kind that did maybe some craft work. A distillery is a really specialized kind of thing. Wasn't that a big leap? Was it, or am I wrong?
You know, it definitely at the time seemed like it could be a big leap, but then came the research. So, you know, we were trying to think of what we wanted to do. And as you said, you know, our default was to think about things that made a little bit more sense. Maybe a Viennese coffee house, but there actually was a Viennese type coffee house in Chicago at the time. Meinl had started one around the same time that we started Koval in 2008. And so we said, okay, well, that's out. So we started, you know, we were home for the holidays, and we brought some of Robert's grandfather's brandy back from Austria for the whole family to enjoy. And we were sitting around the fireplace, and my sister was there, and my brother was there, and my sister's kid, everyone, the whole family was together. And we were drinking this brandy. And my sister said, "This is fabulous. You know, I haven't had anything like this. This tastes like pears, you know, just jumping out of the glass." And my husband went into a whole, you know, discussion of, you know, the merits of, you know, small batch distilling in Austria and, you know, all of the farm to glass and how his grandparents make the brandy. And how they don't really have that same sort of tradition in America as they do in Europe for brandy. And so my father at the time, he used to order all of the Publishers Clearinghouse magazines. So we had maybe like 30 magazines on the coffee table. And one of them was a Time magazine article, Time magazine. We were, you know, leafing through some of these magazines, and it was an article about a distillery in upstate New York that was a craft distillery. And this was sort of a new concept. There, you know, I'd heard of craft brewing, but craft distilling hadn't really entered into, you know, what people thought of when one thought of alcohol, hard alcohol. And so we were reading it, and my sister said, "Well, these guys are doing it. You know, maybe this is what you guys are looking for to do. Maybe you should do this." And it sounded sort of wild, but the idea sort of started working its way into our minds, and we started researching it and looking into all of the government requirements for starting a distillery, looking into all of the requirements for the state, for the federal government, for, you know, we started really just, it became a research project. And then it became why don't we do this?
Well, I can think of a lot of reasons. Let me raise one of them. and I'm sure that research part was fun because you like research. That's in your wheelhouse. So a coffee house, I can kind of understand, because a coffee house is an experience where, if it's done well in terms of atmosphere and the way it's, the ambiance that's created there, it's very nice. A distillery, in theory, competes, even though it's a local distillery, it competes with national brands. So, you know, in there's a lot, I happen to like bourbon. I particularly like Scotch. I like Irish whiskey. I like regular whiskey. It's going to be hard for you to create something that's better than those national brands, I might think. And then the next question would be, were you thinking you'd be able to exploit the localness of it? More specifically, is the distillery itself a destination for people as a place to hang out the way a coffee shop is? Because it doesn't have to be. Sometimes, you know, it is. So right. What were your ideas in the beginning and did they change? And
well, our distillery today is a place where people can come and enjoy a fabulous cocktail. We have a patio, a beautiful bar. But when we started, it certainly was not. We were not a destination. In fact, it was illegal for us to have a bar at our distillery. And I had to, soon after we started our business, I had to start lobbying and trying to figure out a way to change the laws in Illinois so that we could, you know, retail on site. In fact, early on, we were not thinking of having a bar. We were thinking of just the opportunity to invite people into our distillery, let them taste what we make, show them around, and then have them leave through the gift shop, yeah, so to speak. Sure. But that wasn't allowed. We were not allowed to do that. And so, you know, we're starting this business. I've got, you know, small children and I'm driving to Springfield, Illinois, trying to get a new law in the books that allows us to retail on site, do tours and tastings, which I managed to get passed, which really, I think, changed the nature, not just of our business, but all of the distilling industry in Illinois. So in the very beginning, to answer your original question, we weren't thinking about our competition. In fact, we didn't care at all about our competition. We weren't thinking about, you know, creating a destination. We were only thinking about how can we afford the best still possible? How are we going to, you know, mash since we cannot yet afford, you know, the super special, you know, mash tanks with the, you know, glycol chillers and all of the things that, you know, now we have everything. And so what we were thinking about was really all just getting things going. And then to answer your question about, you know, did we think we could make something as well as everybody else? Yes, we definitely did, because, you know, there are different advantages to being small and there are different advantages to being very large. And we'd seen already the advantages of being a small craft distiller from a European standpoint. Robert's grandfather has a functioning distillery and cidery in Austria. You know, we'd visited many small scale distilleries that were doing beautiful work, creating wonderful products that we enjoyed. And we felt that there was something about the ability of movement of a small, you know, not just a distillery, but a small company. You know, you're more nimble. You can do things differently that would not be financially viable or interesting for a very, very large company. And when we started Koval in 2008, there were less than 50 distilleries in the entire United States. And many of them were under the umbrella of maybe about 8 distilleries. So, you know, we felt that there was ample room for us to make our
market. To do something distinctive. And so originally, when you first were dreaming about it, did you have a product list in mind that was different than what you've now ended up with? Or did you plan to expand to what you are now at? Or did you just say, we're just going to make the best bourbon in the United States, and that's what we're going to do?
No, actually, we wanted to make a number of different products. We actually treated it sort of very academically in the beginning, which was a strategy that we realized later on was probably not the best one because, you know, we just were so excited about the industry and about being able to make so many different things that just were not on the market. So we were able to start out and we made a 100% rye whiskey, 100% wheat whiskey, 100% oat whiskey, 100% millet whiskey, 100% spelt whiskey. And then we made them all and in an age, and we aged them in a toasted barrel. So then we had two versions of all of those different whiskeys. And then we said, well, what would they taste like in a charred barrel? So then we had three versions of all of those. And pretty soon we had more whiskeys, you know, in different versions than Starbucks has coffees. And it was really a lot of fun, but from a business standpoint, completely, you know, ridiculous. Yeah. Because, you know, when you start selling to different retail stores and you present them with, you know, 20 options, everyone's going to have their favorite. And then how is anyone going to find, you know, what they're looking for, what they want? So obviously, in the very beginning, we had a huge menu of products, which works very well in a small, you know, middle of nowhere Austrian, you know, farm distillery. But for a in the middle of the city Chicago distillery, it was not the best strategy. So we've reduced it down a bit.
Interesting. Was there a division of labor between you and your husband initially, and has that persisted? And what's dinner like at the Bernicker Hart home? Is it all whiskey all the time?
Well, in the very beginning, it was just a lot of labor and there was no division. We just had to get it done. Yeah. And so it was really just, you know, Robert and, you know, me, we were in the distillery sometimes until, you know, 3 a.m. I remember trying to get our first shipment out and I was nursing. We had a pack and play in the distillery. We had a couch. It was not big enough for two people to lie on it. We worked through the night. We even had to solicit friends to come and help us because we did not realize how long it was going to take to get all of these things done. You know, we came from academic careers. My husband was the deputy press secretary for the Austrian embassy. You know, I'd spent a lot of time in libraries, but not a lot of time bottling, labeling, packaging, you know, all of those types of things and figuring out, you know, how to, you know, how long that would take, you know, just shrink capping. You know, we didn't have like a system where you just put it in and it does it all for you. I mean, we certainly do today, but in the very beginning, each portion of the packaging was done by hand, literally. So put the labels on by hand. We had to then, you know, shrink cap it by hand, you know, cork it by hand, everything, you know, and just shrink capping alone. I mean, I would recommend anyone to give that a try. We had this machine that looked like a industrial hair dryer and it would melt the shrink cap onto the bottle. But it wouldn't always do it beautifully. And so then you had to rip those off and do it again. So it was a huge amount of work. My parents came and helped. And it was really a big, big effort. Friends and family, everybody. And we, you know, it was 5 a.m. and we were about to get, you know, a shipment out. We slept for maybe 15 minutes and then had to continue working again. So in the beginning, it was a lot of work and a lot of just physical labor, you know, doing everything. We had to do so much, you know, by hand that today, you know, we have incredibly modern equipment and it's all, you know, fit with sensors and we can monitor it on iPads and it's really night and day. But in the beginning, it was really, you know, there was that. But then you also had the fact that I was a mother and I had a baby at the time. I was nursing. So I would be nursing. I'd be answering the phones. I'd be helping mash. I'd be, you know, shrink capping. I would, you know, strap the baby on top of me. I gave interviews on television with a baby attached to me. I mean, it was really, it was quite, quite an amazing time. And it was really interesting because, you know, when somebody called the distillery is, as we started gaining a little bit of interest, in the press, you know, the Tribune wrote an article about us and other magazines and started writing about us. We would get a lot of phone calls of people wanting to do what we did. And so when they called, they got my cell phone. And so I'd be like answering the call. I'd have the phone on my shoulder. I'd have a baby next to me. I would be doing the work. I'd be emailing and people would ask me to go through the whole process of setting up a distillery on the phone. And, you know, being an educator, of course, I love helping people, teaching them. But it got to the point where we would field maybe 20 of these calls every few days. And we started saying, come to our workshop. Mm-hmm. And so this became also in the very beginning, an element of our time was devoted to teaching other people. We set up a vertical business model, Kota Distilling Technologies. It became our consulting arm. We worked with the TTB, which is our regulating organization in the government. A TTB officer would come to the distillery and tell people how to do things right. You know, don't keep just a spiral notebook with squiggles in it and a few notes about how much you distilled. They would really show people all the forms that needed to be filled out, how to do things the right way. And we would teach people how to actually make different products. And we set up lots of people. This first wave of craft distilling, many of them came through Chicago. So in some ways, you know, we never left teaching behind. It just sort of shifted. And we started teaching people how to set up, craft distilleries all over the US, Europe, Canada, Africa. People came from all over the world to Chicago to learn how to distill from us. And that was really a wonderfully fun part of the business in the beginning. And so then as we had all these vertical business models, and as we, you know, we're growing all the time, we did need to split up the business a little bit, wherein I took over most of the business side of it, the marketing, the distribution, relations, and Robert took over more of the production and managing the production and also setting up distilleries all over the world. He would go to Uganda and set up distilleries, or Sweden, everywhere.
You have one in Jerusalem, right, that you set up?
Yes.
Thinker's Distillery, well, which is on Agrippa's. And yes, I'm ashamed to say I haven't been there yet, which is hard to believe since I like whiskey and I'm on Agrippa's all the time. So we'll remedy that soon. Did you charge for the workshop, right?
Yes. They helped us. We helped them. It was a wonderful situation. I mean, this was how we were able to grow our business without bringing in investors or without bringing in, you know, huge, huge debt. Because this industry is incredibly expensive, and that becomes a big barrier to entry for many people, because it's not just the startup costs of, you know, getting the initial equipment, and it's also the fact that you are playing futures with your growth. You are trying to imagine how much you're going to grow in about 4 or 5 years. And then you need to buy all those raw materials. You need to produce all of that product, put it away, and pay taxes on it, by the way, also in advance of selling it. And then, you know, hope for the best. So that you reach a point where that becomes prohibitively expensive for a lot of, you know, startups, and then they need capital. And what we did instead is we were very lucky. We created these vertical business models, and in helping people all over the world, I mean, we've had over 3,500 people come to our workshops. We've set up over 200 distilleries turnkey from start to finish for others. We've done consulting. We've done white labeling for brands many you've heard of. And we've done all of these things on the side so that we could then continue to build Koval.
What's white labeling?
White labeling is where you make products for other brands. So we've done some, you know, manufacturing of products for brands in all across the United States and other places. We don't do it as much anymore, but, you know, for example, we did some white labeling for Whistle Pig.
To their specifications or to your, to yes, whatever they asked for?
No, theirs.
And mm-hmm. I think you said, maybe you said this before, there are now 3,000 distilleries in the United States. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. Well, craft distilleries, there are even more than that. When we started, as I said, there were under 50, and now we've gotten close to about 4,000. But you have to understand distillery. It can also mean a rectifier. So they may not do the mashing themselves. They may just bring in product and distill it with botanicals and make a gin. So there are different designations for different kinds of distilleries. But you know, craft distilleries have gone from literally a handful when we started. There might have been, you know, an actual craft distillery. There might have been maybe 10 or 15 when we started. And now, you know, you have about 3,000, I would say. So it's pretty exciting times.
Let's talk about quality control. My wife makes really good sourdough bread. And, you know, we're in Jerusalem. We had she had a certain way to do that with a Dutch oven and to make it come out a certain way and get that thick, the artisanal crust. And she's really good at it. And we come to Jerusalem and she brought her starter with her, because she's serious, and which is something you need to make bread. You need a starter that's alive. It's a crazy thing. And, it comes out different every time now. Or at least for a while. At some point it might stabilize, but it turns out we had a cold winter here. We didn't have much heat. So the bread over the winter was really different. It came out really differently. The idea that she could sell, I think there were people who would pay for it. But in general, when people pay for something, they want to get the same thing the next time. Not always. Sometimes they want like the variety, but usually in a whiskey, what you're making, gin, whatever it is, people kind of like, if they liked it, they kind of want to have the same thing again. How is that possible? At Anheuser-Busch, the people who sell Budweiser, they're really good. One of the things they do really well, which is not straightforward, is that every can of Budweiser tastes the same. And you might think that's because they have somebody taste it each time. And if it doesn't taste the same, they don't use that one. But that isn't the way they do it. So how do you, in your business, keep quality control? It's not just quality, it's essential control. It's whatever is the essence of what you're selling is the same every time. How's that possible?
Absolutely. And it's very, very difficult in whiskey because there are so many factors that you cannot control. You know, for example, barrels, temperature. If, especially for a craft distiller, I mean, we have a lot of modern technology that we use that might not be possible for, you know, some much smaller craft distilleries. But, you know, having an aging place where the temperature is always the same is going to be very difficult. And the barrels, you know, they get charred and there are different levels of charring for barrels, but that doesn't mean there aren't different sort of slight variations in the barrels themselves. So, and as you say, you know, crops are different. We've distilled grain. We get pretty much all of our grain from a local farmer and also a farmer co-op. So that if, for example, there's some sort of issue with one of the farmer's grains, we get grain close by from another farmer. They work together. It's an organic co-op. All of our grains are organic.
And the idea there being that the soil and the acidity and other aspects of the soil at least be very similar, if not the same, right?
Exactly. Because we've also seen in distilling, you know, also for others, you know, we've distilled grain from various parts of the United States and that the grain also is a little bit different. So, you know, we've noticed these differences. So we try and stick, you know, with the Midwest. We've got our grain, our corn all comes from Illinois. You know, our other grains all come from the Midwest, very close to where we are in Chicago, actually. And so with that, there are some things that you can control, but you cannot always control, you know, how the crops are in a particular year or the minutiae of every single barrel. Or what necessarily happens all the time in a, you know, distillation. You know, sometimes there are things that can happen. And that's where technology comes in to help you make sure that things are going to be as consistent as possible. And so we have We employ a lot of technology. We believe that this is an art and a science, you know, so we love the tasting aspect and trying things. But we also love the science aspect of making sure that there are sensors everywhere, that we're never flying blind, that we can monitor what's happening in our still so that if there's a slight temperature variation that we can correct it immediately, we get an alert. You know, if the flow rate changes, we get an alert immediately, we can change it. So all of these things that we can control are controlled. Now, there come the things, as we've talked about already, that you can't always control. And so what we do is that we make sure that we're tasting before we're bottling. And that's where you can sort of notice, oh, this actually tastes a little bit more in a caramel direction than our traditional products. It doesn't mean it's bad. It's just slightly different. And that can be because of maybe the temperatures that year, maybe the grain, there are possibilities. And so if something tastes, you know, noticeably different, it does get pulled off. And here's one of those advantages that I say of sort of being a small brand is that we can do that and then have sort of some unique and interesting special barrels for people. And people love those, true, you know, because they are a little bit different or they are fun. The quality is the same. It's just the character might be slightly different. And so then that becomes a unique and special program.
That's very cool. When you did the first set of batches and you tasted it, and maybe you'll tell me, but I could imagine that you didn't like it so much. You say, well, this isn't quite what we were aiming for. Sometimes when I taste a craft beer, you know, it might be extremely hoppy. And some people like that. And that's fine. But sometimes it's just not that good. And you wonder, could they not make it better? Could they not afford to make it better? So when you think about the product that you're creating, how much control do you have over what we might call the quality, which of course is inherently subjective, but if you're aiming for a quality that you enjoy drinking, which would be my sort of starting place, ideally other people too, how do you change that if you're not happy with it? Were you happy with it when it first came out, the first few batches, or did you go back to the drawing board? And what is that? What's on that drawing board?
Sure. I mean, we had very strict rules for ourselves, and keep in mind, my husband grew up distilling. So this was not new to him. He wasn't just troubleshooting this. This was his, you know, chores growing up as a kid on his grandparents' farm. And so he had done a lot of the troubleshooting. He'd seen a lot of things that can happen. And they were distilling something that was very difficult, actually, to distill, a lot more difficult than grain on some levels, which is fruit. And they also worked with berries, which is very difficult because, you know, you know how quickly berries can have problems even in your refrigerator. So just imagine, you know, trying to ferment those. So he had a lot of experience. But what we wanted to do, which was unique in America at the time, is take a European approach, a brandy approach to distilling, and apply it to grain. So already from the very beginning, our approach was going to be unique and very different from what was the playbook for American whiskey at the time. And what I mean by taking a brandy approach is when you are distilling mashing and distilling an apricot, you are very conscious of each and every apricot. You cannot put one bad apricot in because it literally will wreck everything. If you're distilling pears, you know, in Austria, there are different schools, but if you really want to do it, in our opinion, the cleanest, the brightest, the right way, you will take the stems off. You know, you will make sure that, for example, with apricots, you will take out the pits. So there, you know, some people do, some people don't, but we, you know, sort of felt that we wanted to do everything as best as possible, which always tends to mean a lot more work.
But how does apricots and pears get you to grain? What was the analogy?
Okay. That's a good question. It's So already there are a lot of things that you have to sort of think about when you're working on the mashing process. But what also brandy distillers need to think about very carefully is the paying attention to the mash, making sure that they're doing that, that they're adding the yeast properly. And that's something that you have to do no matter what you're distilling. But then with the fermentation process, making sure that all the starches convert over to sugars, that you're then distilling it at the right time. And then the distilling process is for brandy is very particular in that when you were distilling really anything, it comes off in three parts. Heads, they will make you go blind and crazy. Do not drink them. They're full of all sorts of chemical compounds that you might find in nail polish remover. Very bad for you. Then you have the hearts. That's what people drink. That's the good stuff. That's pure ethanol. And then you have the tails, which are a number of different compounds. You have, they're often called the long ends. There are many names for the tails, but they have similar chemical compounds to what you might find in vinegar, for example. Not necessarily bad, just kind of interesting, sort of off flavors. And for a brandy distiller who's looking to let that pear shine, that pear that we were drinking on that holiday evening that my sister said, this is amazing. They would never add the tails. And the reason being, it's not that the tails are bad for you, like the heads. They're not. They might also add some interesting flavors. They're also oily. And they're a little bit oilier in their, composition. But if you are going for a brandy that is not aged, that needs to stand on its own and be bright and clean, you would never add the tails. Now, in America, it is very traditional when you're making whiskey. And also if you think about making millions and millions and millions of gallons of whiskey, it's likely, very likely, that much of the tails will also end up in the product. Because when you take the hearts, the pure ethanol, and you mix it with some of the tails, and then you put it in a barrel, it's heavily charred, and you age it for an extended period of time, the barrel acts as a filter. And the barrel will pull out some of those off-putting flavor notes and some of those off-putting smells, because tails by themselves sort of taste and smell like a wet dog. Now, when you release that whiskey after 4 or 5 years, it's going to be rounded. It's going to be nice. It's going to have a flavor that I would say is very easily recognizable as an American whiskey. And it's great. And it's loved by millions of people all over the world. It is, however, different than a whiskey that did not have any tails in it, that is aged with only the heart cut, that is then put in a barrel where the barrel really doesn't need to filter anything, because you're not adding anything into the barrel that in its own essence before the barrel is a little bit like off, then you're getting a very different product. And that's what we were going for. We wanted to create a product that was going to be unique, that was going to make good on Robert's heritage of, his grandparents and their brandy tradition, and apply that to grain, because we wanted the rye to shine just itself, its purest form, just as the oat, just as the millet. And that's sort of the identity that we wanted for our distillery.
Now, I could imagine, when you say classic, standard, mainstream American whiskeys, what do you have in mind? Can you mention those names?
No,
are you talking about Jack Daniels?
I think anybody.
Are you talking about Jack Daniels?
I don't know their specifics, okay. But I can imagine that large scale distilleries are, if I were running one, I probably would not want to not use alcohol that is completely usable and that there's nothing wrong with it. It just has very different chemical components to it than the heart cut and the pure ethanol.
So did some of your customers initially find your flavor off-putting because it wasn't what they were used to?
They said it was different, and it is different. Our products are very clean. They're very bright. But then again, you know, what was really interesting is that, you know, a number of years into our business, you started having this love and interest in Japanese whiskey. And a lot of Japanese whiskey also uses similar approach. Some of them are very sort of, I would imagine, just having tasted them, I can tell. A lot of them use, if not mostly the hard cut, at least a tighter cut than I might imagine some American brands use. And it creates just a different flavor profile. And so our products, our whiskeys do very well in Japan. And I can see why. We have a very clean, bright flavor profile to all of our grain whiskeys.
So going back to my earlier question, that was fantastically interesting. I want to come back and go into a few more details. But did your first batch taste good? Were you happy with it?
I mean, we were happy with it because we did not use any tails. For us, it was, we had a different metric. We were going for very clean whiskeys. So from a scientific standpoint, we wanted just the pure ethanol in our whiskeys. And we achieved that. And that's what we wanted. And so we were very, very happy with it. There were different whiskeys that we tried that, you know, in adding things, we were purists in the beginning. So we only would use just rye. And even today, our rye is 100% rye, whereas many ryes on the market are only 51% rye, because that's what the US government says a rye has to be, 51% rye. But you still might be getting a lot of wheat or corn or something else. But we were purists. But I think we started having a little bit of fun, even more fun, when we started mixing grains as well. And you know, when we made our bourbon, when we made our four grain whiskey, those were a lot of fun for us because we realized the complexity of flavor then that would come out in these sort of mixed grain whiskeys that we, you know, did not necessarily have in our 100% grain whiskeys, which we also loved, but they were just very specific. And then, you know, making our bourbon was a lot of fun because we were trying to create a bourbon that was also sort of unique and different than what you have on the market. And so we did not want to use the usual suspects. We did not want to make a bourbon, you know, with rye or wheat or malted barley. So we said, let's make our bourbon with millet, which is a fabulous grain. It's incredibly unique. It's one of the few grains that's basic as opposed to acidic. It is used in a lot of gluten-free breads. It is has a completely different habit, you know, in the way that it grows. It's a fun grain. It's very popular in other parts of the world, just not in the United States. And so, you know, we achieved this notion of trying to create a bourbon that is very uniquely ours. And that's part of the fun. That's what we wanted to do. We really wanted to have fun and make really, you know, high quality products that were unique and different.
I thought bourbon was made out of corn. It's not.
It has to be 51% corn.
So when you say millet, and, what do you mean?
Well, our mash bill, sort of the recipe, is corn and millet.
Okay. So let's talk.
Whereas the typical bourbon mash bill is corn and malted barley, corn and rye, corn and wheat and malted barley, corn and malted barley and you know, wheat. So it's different combinations of those secondary grains, whereas the primary grain needs to be corn. So 51% corn.
Let's talk about the mash, a phrase you've used a number of times. What sure. is that?
The mash is the, you know, when you are making a whiskey, in fact, when you're making beer, when you're making sort of any, you know, beer or whiskey, because the beginning is very similar. Brewers call it their wort, or distillers, you know, beer. We call it our mash. It's basically where you're making a soup almost of grain, water, and yeast. And that's very similar for brewers for making beer. For a distiller, that's what we use. There are different approaches that one can take to the mash. Some just use the yeast and some will use malted barley in their mash. Not necessarily only for flavor, but also to help crack the starches, which is something that has been very, very traditional in America. In fact, it's so traditional. There's a funny anecdote about this, if you'll indulge me.
Please.
So, so there was a gentleman in a scientist in Japan who came to America during one of the World's Fairs. I think that was in New Orleans, and he had this science of, you know, fermentation that he'd been studying, and he came across it in looking at sake and how sake ferments, and he was looking at the rice and I think koji was what he was focusing on, and he came across this realization, because the science around distilling is still full, and alcohol for that matter is still full of mystery and questions. I mean, there's a great book called Proof, and it looks into the science behind all of the different stages of making alcohol, and including the intoxication, around which there are a lot of questions. You know, sometimes, you know, there's so many factors that come to play in it, both environmental as well as what you've actually ingested, that it's fascinating science. Either way, this gentleman, he came to this conclusion that there was a much better, more efficient, and cleaner way to mash whiskey than was being, you know, well, them was very common in the United States at the time, and wanted to bring this new technology. In fact, it was the first biotech patent in the United States, was actually for enzymes for distilling. So from him. So basically what he said is he then brought this technology to Illinois. So this has a very Chicago and Illinois side of the story. He brought this technology to Illinois when we had the World's Fair here, and had a meeting in Peoria, Illinois, which was the main distilling hub in the United States at the turn of the century. Everyone thinks it's Kentucky or Tennessee. No. It was Peoria. Unfortunately, it lost its luster, and it then moved down to Kentucky. But Peoria was producing most of the alcohol in the U.S., I believe, at the time. So he went there to meet with all of these distillers and said, look, you don't need malted barley anymore. Which was very also time consuming. It was a big process to malt the barley. It took a lot of space. And he said, look, you don't need that. You need enzymes, and that will do the job. And it's all natural. And this is exactly what will make your production more efficient and better and cleaner and easier. And so some of the distilleries in Peoria said, this sounds like a great idea, and started using it. And then they burned down. and then the firemen who came to put out the fires, surprisingly, had no water. They couldn't get water. And after this happened a few times, I think they got the message.
But the distillers were burning down because the enzymes created what?
No, because of the barley mafia.
Oh, what happened?
They didn't want distilleries using the new technology because it would put them out of business.
Oh, this is awesome.
See, I just assumed that was clear because I come from, you know, the Chicago, Illinois. It's like, of course there was somebody that, you know, was just sending them a message.
And that's why there was...
That it had nothing to do with the enzymes being dangerous.
That's why there was no water, because they switched it off and made sure they couldn't put out the fire.
Yeah.
So for the listeners who have been longtime listeners, haven't talked about this in a long time, but... This is a great example of bootleggers and Baptists. For those listening, in a certain sense, not exactly the Baptist part, but bootleggers don't like competition. So, and barley makers don't like competition. And so, this is a fabulous example of how, when property rights are insecure, sometimes you don't get the best outcomes. Not really bootlegger and Baptist, but I had to get that in somehow. Okay,
of course.
Let's talk about single malt. Which I think about it as a Scotch thing. So I think it's a bit of a form of snobbery. I think there are non-single malt scotches that are quite drinkable. Johnny Walker being the most well-known by most people. Johnny Walker just makes the same kind of whiskey each time. They have different colors. They have green, black, blue, red. But it's not just in whiskey, right? It's single malt's general thing. Tell me what it is, and is it a thing, and should it be?
Well, single malt, you know, there are a lot of things in whiskey. And if I could just quickly back up, because I hate not giving somebody credit, but the gentleman that came up with that was Yokichi Takamine, was the name of the scientist that came up with enzyme.
And you use enzymes now, you're saying? It is now?
We use enzymes. Others might use malted barley, but the whole point, and of course, as I digress, but the whole point was that we use enzymatic conversions of starches to sugars so that we can have a very clean whiskey that is 100% rye without ever having, you know, seen other grains, you know?
Okay. So exactly. Go to single malt.
But exactly. So with regard to single malt, there are many, you know, things in whiskey. I would say there's a lot of marketing in whiskey too. But single malt is a designation, just like bourbon is a designation. And if we're going to jump to another alcohol category, champagne is also another designation. These are all designations that are, you know, geographical in their nature. So, you know, single malt whiskeys are, you know, primarily, although this is very topical because America is creating an American single malt. Right now as a category. We didn't have it before. It was primarily, you know, would come out of Scotland. And really, it's just using malt, malted barley.
Well, I got to ask, ask an embarrassing question. Sure. What is malt exactly?
it's where you have, you know, there are many things that can be malted. You can malt all sorts of kinds of grains. It's a process in which it's sort of like smoked and it's dried. And there are many different processes for malting different things. But, you know, it's a way to change the character and flavor of a grain, but it changes, breaks it down. Okay. And it helps start the process. So in a way, that's why it's great to use malted barley to help crack the starches and sugars, because it gets it started. It gets it really moving. And that's why it's used. But I would say it's also a flavor. It's a delicious flavor. It's, you know, I love, you know, the malted barley, and there are different levels that it can be malted. So it can have more smoky type flavors. It can have more caramel type flavors. It can have more chocolatey type flavors. It really just depends on the malter. And while I'm not a malter myself, so I mean, that could be an interesting thing to ask, because one can get lots of different flavor profiles out of malt, malting different grains and also barley for that matter. But that's what it is.
I was going to say either a malter nor a Menderby, but I'll let that go. Bad dad joke for Shakespeare fans. What is, so what's single malt?
A single malt is just, you're only using the malted barley. You're just using that one malted barley. There are different, you know, there might be different things where it's just of one harvest. There might be different marketing, you know, techniques of different things in America. They're trying to figure out what our designation is going to be. Is it going to be distilled at a certain, level? Is it going to be, I think that they're fleshing out the details right now as to what is going to constitute an American single malt. But it's really has been primarily a Scottish type of whiskey. I mean, and then you can add different things. I mean, then there's peated whiskeys, which is also, you know, something that happens a lot in Scottish whiskey. these, that they're starting to do. Some distilleries in the United States are starting to use peat as well. But, you know, there, it,
so what does that mean?
It's just really what the chef wants
well,
to
what's
make.
What does that mean? Like, I'm a big fan of peated whiskeys, of Scotch especially. It's my, those are my favorites. Lagavulin, Lafroy.
Right.
I'm blanking on Ardbeg.
Right.
What does that mean, peated? And it tastes smoky. I've mentioned this before. My favorite right. marketing slogan of all time, a drinker of Lafroy won, I think, won a contest, who said that drinking Lafroy is like kissing a mermaid who has been eating barbecue. There is, I don't think, any right. better expression to capture Lafroy. Oh, there's some less attractive ones. How is the peat? Peat is something from the ground, like dirt. how yes. is that integrated into the process?
Well, you know, they use the peat sort of similar to the fact that, you know, malted barley, it's first, you know, you're sprouting the grain, whether you're using barley or whether you're using some other grain and you're malting it, you're sprouting it, getting it started, and then you're using fire, you know, and different amounts, you know, to dry it or to smoke it or to, you know, make it have one sort of flavor versus another. You know, peat, it's natural. It comes from, the ground. It's organic substances that I think are pressed into certain, I guess it's like a bog, to be perfectly honest. We don't use any peat, so I'm not an expert in peat. But I know that there are peat fields in England. I've been to them in Scotland, and what they do is they harvest it out of the ground and then they'll smoke it. Or they will, you know, use the, you know, either like a heavy smoke or a light smoke onto it. And that obviously affects the flavor and aroma of the grain. But how they use it exactly in different minutiae is beyond me, because I do not use peat
you're spared,
at all.
but I have to go back to something you said earlier. We're talking about the heart, and you said it's pure
yes.
ethanol, right?
Yes.
So ethanol is something you might use in a science
yes.
experiment. It doesn't.
Yes, you
it,
would.
It, in theory, it has no flavor. I would say. I'm guessing.
Right. In theory, but that really depends.
So my question is,
because
why would you want to make something that's 100% ethanol? Is it going to have any flavor?
Well, it depends on how you distill it. So you can distill it very high. So, for example, you've probably seen different stills. And so there are three different kinds of stills out there. One is a sort of a pot still that you might see in Scotland, for example. And sometimes they have a swan helmet. Which is sort of the top part's beautiful. And what they would do there is they would distill it, probably more than once to get the alcohol content, the ethanol, the content, up to a certain percentage of alcohol.
And the right? distilling is to get rid of non-alcoholic pieces of it to get it down to its
right.
essence.
And to bring it down to its essence. But every time you distill something, you bring it up in alcohol content, so to speak. I mean, that's a very big simplification. But so, for example, if you have a still, we have a hybrid still, which mixes both the pot still that I mentioned that you might find in Scotland, and then more industrial still that you might find, which is just columns. So as you can see behind me, you know, it's a pot and there are columns. Now, the benefit of that is that if we want to distill it low so that it doesn't go up to a high alcohol content, you know, 95%, 95 point something, which is really high. And that would be like around a vodka, where you will have stripped it of all of its flavor and aroma. To get there, you need to distill it through a number of plates. So you need to take it, you know, different stills, depending on their technology. Depending on whether they have deflegmeters attached to them, can do that, you know, with different amounts of plates. But in general, you need two pretty large columns to get vodka. Now, you don't want that much rectification in a bourbon, for example, or in a rum, or in, you know, whiskey even. You know, you really want the flavor of the grain to shine through. So whether it's distilled to maybe 91%, 90, 88, these are all different variations that, you know, a distiller can play with, and that also help determine the character of the kind of whiskey that you're making. So that's, you know, how one would get really a high rectification. It would have to go through a lot of distillation, so to speak, or a number of plates, because each plate is a distillation, to get a really high rectification.
This is a question for my son, who's a big fan of your four grain. Is it four grain whiskey? Is that what it's called?
Yeah,
four grain whiskey. I didn't know he'd had it, but when I told him I was interviewing you, I asked him if he knew your distiller, and he said he did. I mentioned to you before we started doing this that my wife encountered your whiskey at the duty-free section of Melbourne's airport, which is really weird. and it sent me a picture of it for no reason, I don't think. I don't think she knew I was interviewing you. But my son wants to know is how long do you decide to age it? Because there's a trade-off, classic economics, that you know your money is sitting in the barrel. It could be out in the whiskey could be out in the store, which would in turn give you money to spend now rather than later. And in general, the higher interest, higher interest rates are, the more expensive it is to leave it in the barrel rather than having it in your bank. So how do you decide how long to age it for? And do the lower interest rates these days make that any different for you? Economist question.
Well, yeah, no, for sure. So, the first part of it, we always wanted to, you know, age our whiskeys, and we did a number of experiments, and we've also done experiments with different size barrels, and, you know, because that also affects the flavor, you know, if you're using different size barrels based on the, you know, the surface area. And also there's a difference as to whether you char the heads of the barrels or you toast them. And also the varying levels of firing of the barrels. So how charred it is, whether it's an alligator char or a lighter or a darker char. So after we went through a number of experiments, we settled on wanting our whiskeys to be between around 4 and 5 years before they get pulled. And for us, it's really not, you know, about the number, although the numbers are important because in certain countries, you have to age your products a certain amount of time. But for us, it was really about what you mentioned earlier, consistency. So consistency is incredibly important. And sometimes, as we spoke about, you know, you will pull a rye barrel and you will notice that, whoa, this got a lot more caramel, you know, than it normally would in this amount of time. And so, as I said, you know, then that, you know, it may be absolutely delicious, but we're not going to want to, you know, have it be the same as our main line, which has, you know, a different flavor profile. So we want to keep our products consistent. And so we make sure that we pull also for consistency. So if it needs a little more time in the barrel, it'll get a little more time in the barrel. And if it's ready at around 4 years, then we will pull it. But really we're going for consistency. So that's what affects, you know, our decisions along the aging process.
When you say it came out real caramelly, is that you or your husband's palate? Is that a subjective judgment by a taster, maybe one of you or someone else, or is there a chemical composition of it that you measure?
Well, we've measured chemical compositions all the time, but it's also, you know, you can tell if something is not tasting like your main line. I mean, we also have a lot, we all taste it, you know, and sometimes we'll deliberate, but you know, that's all of our barrels, all of our products are single barrels. So for us, it really is important that we try and make sure that they all taste the same. You know, a lot of companies, what they do to eliminate these issues is they blend a lot of barrels just together. And then you're going to have, you know, a level of consistency because those little slight variations in blending them all together are not going to really come through.
So is single barrel a thing? What is single barrel?
A single barrel is a thing. It is, you know, where we can trace every single bottle back to the field on which the grain was grown. And it's that level of transparency that we love. I mean, we can really trace everything back, and we also have to. I mean, we're organic certified, and with our organic certification, what will happen is they will come and they will ask for all of the records of, you know, from the farmers that we purchased it from. And the farmers need to be up to date on their organic certifications. Obviously, we need to be up to date on all of our organic certifications and everything, you know, the yeast, you name it, that is in our product, all the different grains. They need to be all organic, and they need to know exactly when it was purchased and what field it was on, and all of that. So that's for us, single barrel is in part the art of trying to create this level of consistency, even though each barrel might have very, very minor slight variations to them. But it also allows us a business format in which when those barrels do come about that are somewhat different, because they've taken on, you know, some different flavors. Probably maybe it was a really hot summer, or, you know, maybe it was really cold, you know, and these things might affect it. Even though we have a temperature controlled warehouse, you know, it's controlled to some degree, but you know, when you have these extreme temperature shifts as we do in Illinois, you know, where you can have a number of days that are 110 or many, many days that it's, you know, polar vortex, you are going to definitely have some slight variation.
When you say single barrel, do you mean it's the grain is coming from a similar area, or the barrel itself? What do you explain that again?
Yeah, everything. So all the grain comes from, so for example, there are so many terms in whiskey. We have a bottled and bond whiskey, and that has to be grain from one sort of harvest period, all, you know, made at the same time in one facility, in our facility, and bottled in our facility. And it needs to then be at 55% alcohol in the bottle. So there are a lot of these specifics that are required by law if it's going to be bottled in bond. And obviously the bond, it's in our bonded warehouse. So all of this is done to create a product that meets those specifications, so that anybody that buys a bottled and bond whiskey knows that it comes from all grain from one specific time period, and that it is, you know, all done in one facility, that it's traceable, that they know really where it's coming from. And in a world where, you know, so many things, you know, you don't know where it's coming from necessarily, you don't know how it's made, it's nice to know exactly how certain things are made. And I think that there are a lot of people in sort of the whiskey world that love those kinds of details. Now, when we talk about single barrel is, for us, we have the grain, it comes from the farmer, we trace it all the way through to that specific barrel, it gets filled. And it is, when we bottle it, we're not blending it, we're not adding anything. So everything is traced, goes into that barrel, and then it comes out of that barrel into bottles that are numbered, tracing them back to not just the barrel, but also the grain and everything else. So it's also all completely traceable. Now, that's not necessarily true if you're getting a blended whiskey, or, you know, a whiskey where, you know, they are making very, very large batches, and then they stick it in a big vat and then they bottle it, which would be a much larger scale operation.
Let's talk about distribution.
Sure.
A lot of times, a lot of people believe, well, I'll say it differently. The whiskey business has a history of not dissimilar from what you were talking about earlier with the barley people who resorted to violence to keep their market share. In sort of folklore, in movies, Netflix series, people in the whiskey business kind of do things a certain way. And there's a certain edginess to that business that I actually associate with Chicago to some extent. So here you are in Chicago. You make this great product. I've never had it. I'm gonna give you the benefit of the doubt for the short run. And I got my son's recommendation.
Thank you.
So how do you get anybody to be able to buy it? I mean, was that hard, or was that relatively easy? And where, and are there places where it was, it's impossible still, and it's driving you crazy? And I'm thinking about both in bars as well as, which, you know, very limited shelf space often. So you have bars and you have liquor stores, and you know, in my mind, you'd go door to door and say, you want to buy some of this? Here, taste it. But of course, it's a very organized process. And so I assume that's not what happened. So what happened? How'd you deal with that?
Well, in the very beginning, you know, we didn't know anything about the liquor business. You know, we knew about how to make alcohol. You know, we, you know, Robert went back to Europe and took many courses on things that he hadn't learned from his grandfather to increase his knowledge even more. You know, we spoke with all of the manufacturers of the equipment. And so, you know, we became manufacturers representatives of the equipment, which gave us a huge insight into that side of the business, the hardware, you know, different stills, different helmets, different technologies of plates. But when it came down to the liquor business, that was a completely different situation. It was very, very, very eye-opening from the beginning. And it was incredibly eye-opening because we realized early on that it's a business that you can be in and not be able to sell anything if you don't have a distributor.
Right.
So you can be a distiller, but unless you have a distributor, you're not going to sell anything. And now laws have started to change that do allow for some self-distribution. It's not universal by any stretch throughout the United States. And some states allow it only if you're using, you know, grain from that state. And then, you know, how far are you going to get with just self-distribution? I mean, one has to also understand that that is a completely separate business. It's like another vertical. It's also very difficult. And, you've got a lot on your plate already just making the alcohol and doing all the work that's required for the main business. So when we started, we had a hard time finding a distributor. You know, there weren't any really, you know, craft distilleries that people knew about. It wasn't common knowledge. You know, we had a very large distributor who actually is now our distributor in a number of states told us when we went and presented our product to them, they were very nice. And they said, you know, we think you're brave to do this. You got a lot of competition. And of course, we looked on their wall and it was all the big brands. And they said, and we actually think your product is good. They said, but you know, we're not going to be right for you. You're not going to be able to compete where, you know, we can't do anything for you. So go work on your business. And when you graduate, then come and talk to us. So, you know, it was that was sort of the lesson we got, you know, from a large distributor when we first started out. I'm happy we've graduated, but I mean, it was really hard getting there. And in the beginning, you know, just trying to find a distributor was difficult. And then even when you got a distributor, it was very difficult because, you know, we started out with a wonderful, but smaller, distributor who, you know, didn't have a large sales force. So we had to basically help him. You know, we were selling as much as we were doing everything else. And you know, I remember, you know, taking my son, in the stroller for a walk down Clark Street in Andersonville and, you know, putting in the bottom of the stroller, a bunch of whiskeys and some liqueurs and some, you know, of our products and knocking on doors. And they thought that I was like a mom that wanted to like come in with her baby. And I said, you know, I own the distillery, you know, a few blocks away. Do you have a minute? I'd love to taste you out on my line. And they were so shocked. And I think it sort of took them off guard that I was, you know, multitasking, taking my baby for a walk and also, you know, tasting out the local businesses on my product. But really that was how I started to learn about the sales side of the business. And they would talk to me and they would say, you know, I would love to bring in your product. But come over here, look at this, closet. And I would look in the closet and it was full of cases of a particular brand of something. And he would say, you know, the distributors come. I ask for this. They bring me all these extra cases. They think I really want it. It's just sitting around here. He's like, I don't have any room even, you know, for other stuff. And they would tell me all the issues, you know, it's a hand sell, you know, what is that? That means then they have to take more time to educate their customers on what it is, you know, or I'd go to somebody and they would say, oh, I can't bring you on. And I would say, why? And they would say, well, I can't really tell you the details, but you know, this other brand is building a patio for me and I don't want to lose it. Or somebody would say, well, it's a competing brand with this other brand. They're sending me to France and I, you know, don't want to lose my trip. Or, you know, so I started learning a lot about how this business was run. And there was a lot of shadiness. And there were a lot of expectations put on brands. And we were not, you know, we realized that, you know, that was not a game we could play. It just wasn't. It wasn't a game we wanted to play. It wasn't a game we could play. We did not, you know, have endless, you know, cash resources. You know, we were living in my mom's house, saving money, investing everything back into the business. And it's funny because, you know, we were right next to a brewery, Metropolitan Brewing Company. They were right next to us. We started at the exact same time. And we would talk about these issues in, you know, trying to sell our products and how we both would run up against this desire for, you know, free goods or money or all sorts of things that, you know, neither of us were willing to do. And, you know, the brewery told me how there was this restaurant. She'd just come back from trying to sell a lot of her beer. And she said there was this restaurant that said that, sure, they'd put it on, but they would have to bring them a growler every week, you know.
A large container
she said,
of beer.
Yeah. And I said, you know, I just had that exact same experience where, you know, this really nice restaurant said that they would bring, you know, my product on. And then they expected it to be free. And we were both talking about this and we said, you know what, if we stick it out and we just keep trying to do things right, eventually they'll bring it on and then they'll pay. And they did.
I have to say a growler is one of my favorite words in the English language. I love that word. But what legislation makes it difficult? What existing legislation makes it difficult for a new beer or whiskey to break into the market? What needs to change?
There's no legislation.
You said
the legislation is the legislation's fine. It's just the way the business industry has developed over time is one in which there's a lot that goes on that is tricky. And the thing is while there might be legislation against these kinds of activities, you know, where you can't, you know, you legally cannot drop off a check at a bar and wink, wink and say, okay, so now all of your cocktails are going to be ours. It happens, you know, clearly we don't do that. But I know it happens. I know that, you know, there are all sorts of types of shadiness in the liquor industry, and it's not just limited to one state.
But why is it? Usually that would create an opportunity for a newcomer to have a different model. So is there something that makes it difficult for that newcomer? Is there a barrier to entry?
We have a different model. We don't do that. We can't do that.
No, I don't mean
that.
You. I mean the distillery. I mean the distributor. Why isn't there a distributor who says, hey, we're going to give you a better deal. We're going to give you more than our competitors. We're not expected to give us any prizes or golf carts or trips to France or whatever. Is it hard to enter the distribution business? I've always thought there's a tinge of violence there. Is there?
Well, look, at the end of the day, it is a people business. And I believe that anybody that is a people person can start a people business. And they will find individuals that don't care about being shady and don't care about trips to France and really just want to do business with people they care about and that they like and that they think, you know, have the same mindset. That being said, you will always run into people who like trips to France and golfing and all sorts of other treats and tchotchkes and chefs. So it's as simple as that. And while there are, you know, laws against certain things like that, there's also the difficulty of enforcing.
Yeah, I just think it's my intuition that there are certain industries in America, not many, that have a history of being run by people who are happy to go outside the law if you don't play with them the way they want to be played with, that it's different in other industries, like the book distribution business. There's a few places, it's not highly competitive, there's a handful, and there's a couple really big ones, and they have a very strong say in how the market works, but you could start a new one in theory, and they're not going to burn your books down, your book warehouse down. Whereas I feel like in the liquor right. distribution business, that Marley story is not that different today. Maybe. I don't know.
Right. Well, I mean, it's like this. I mean, you can read countless articles, you know, related to the liquor industry of people doing things wrong and getting caught. And then they might change, and they do. And I have seen change happen in this industry, certainly over the last, you know, 5 years, where there have been crackdowns. I think that the TTB has cracked down on certain things. I think that, you know, various liquor control boards have cracked down on certain things. And I think that's good because it means that, you know, some of the overt things that I think might have been happening happen a lot less. That being said, this is an industry that's about, you know, it's about good times. It's very competitive. It's a business that takes place in bars, in restaurants, in hotels, in lobbies, in various places. It's not always a boardroom. It's about the people on the ground going into these businesses and figuring out how to sell. And the way they might figure it out. I mean, and I don't even, you know, think that it's always something that the distributors themselves are even aware of. You know, sometimes it might just be the rep.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, engaging in certain activities on the side to give a brand an edge or not. And so these are the kinds of things that happen. But at the end of the day, you know, as I teach my children, you know, you're going to encounter a lot of people that don't play by the rules. If the rules are good and true, then there's no reason to break them. And you'll find people that that appreciate that. And those are the people that you really want to do business with anyway.
Why is it called Koval?
Koval. Well, so much of Koval is really about being inspired by family. And Koval, the name, is also part of that. When we were trying to think of a name for our company, we were still living in DC and we were getting ready to move to Chicago to make our big business shift. And we went to go visit my great uncle Sigmund in Brooklyn. He was in his late 90s at the time, and we didn't think that we would be able to see him again, probably given all that we had on our plates and moving to Chicago. And so we spent the day with him. He was from Vienna. We were speaking German and he was telling me all about his, you know, friends in Vienna who are people that I read about, you know, and so they're my friends too, but you know, he actually experienced them, alive. And, you know, we told him that we were going to be leaving our careers and starting a business in Chicago, making whiskey and gin and other alcohol. And he said, "Nagi," which is sort of Viennese slang for no way, but in an excited sort of way. And we said, "Yeah." And then he started to say that he thought it sounded like a fabulous adventure. And then he told me that it reminded him of my great grandfather, whose name was Monic or Emmanuel. And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, you know, he you know, did something very strange, you know, in the eyes of our family. And that was that he walked down the stairs one day, you know, after studying at the Technical University in Berlin. He was an electrical engineer. He walked down the stairs and he said, you know, Europe's over. It's about America. I'm moving to America. I'm starting a business. And then he left. And this was really, this was at the sort of turn of the century when Vienna was really the center of the universe at that time, culturally. I mean, it was a great place to be. And his whole family thought he was a little bit out of the ordinary for doing this. And so they gave him the nickname Koval, which in many European languages is a common family name. It's like Smith. It really means Smith. It means like blacksmith. And in German, it's Schmied. But in Koval in Yiddish, it means something a little extra. It means someone who's sort of like a blacksmith, forges something new, like takes something hard, like metal, something that is difficult to work with, and then bends it and makes it something new. And so they gave him that as a nickname. And then he had a blacksmith as his ex libris, which I never understood, being that he was an electrical engineer, and started a battery company. But, you know, the story was fascinating. And as we're taking the train from Brooklyn, you know, from New York back to DC, Robert and I, we were talking about this, and we said, you know, wouldn't Koval be a great name for the company? Because people think we're a little bit out of the ordinary for leaving our careers to start a liquor company in Chicago. But it also honors both sides of our family. You know, it comes from, you know, it's a family name on my side of the family, but Robert learned how to distill from his grandfather, whose last name is Schmied. So, which also means Koval. So it sort of worked out really beautifully. And that's what we took on. But there's actually an addendum to this story, which is that as we grew, you know, Koval grew dramatically in the beginning, and we ran out of space. You know, our first location we thought was big when we moved in, and then very quickly it was small. And then we kept trying to find more spaces, for, you know, storage, you know, just, we needed, you know, we started ordering, you know, at a higher, you know, volume of, we started ordering pallets and pallets as well. And where are you going to put all of these things? You know, it's cheaper when you buy more, but then you need a place to put it. And so, you know, this was always a problem of ours for many, many years. And we kept renting sort of, you know, satellite warehouses. And finally, you know, about in, I think it was 2014, we found the space that we're in today. And half of this building was for rent. And we went in and it was huge and we were really nervous. It was very expensive. And there was nothing in the warehouse at the time when we were walking through, except for some bricks stacked up. And then I noticed there was one thing sort of up by a pillar in the middle of the factory. And I walked over to it. I could barely believe my eyes. But it was a KW battery charger from my great grandfather's battery company, which hasn't existed since the 70s. And I said to the person that was showing us around, I said, Mario, you know, if we rent this building, can we buy this battery charger from you? And he says, if you rent this building, you can have it. You know, the last tenants, they left it here. And so it was beshared. It was meant to be. So we actually have this battery charger and we used it to charge our forklifts. It still works. Wow. So my great grandfather was a very good electrical engineer, but that's sort of about the name and how family has sort of woven its way into it.
My guest today has been Sonnet Bernecker Hart. Sonnet, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.